does whether you've actually been infected with SARS-CoV-2 have anything to do with reporting persistent symptoms?
In patients with multiple blockages in the arteries of the heart, are stents as good as bypass surgery?
The 100,000 genomes pilot at rare disease diagnosis in the UK.
And does your mind control the fate of your heart?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
All right. So I am so totally intrigued, of course, by this query of does your mind control your heart, that I think we should turn right to JAMA and examine this issue.
All right, Elizabeth, we know people that have coronary artery disease, that is blockage in their arteries, are more predisposed to developing either a heart attack in the future or developing heart failure in the future. And one of the conventional ways of testing for that is to do a stress test. But it's been noted about 1 in 6 individuals actually have what's called mental stress-induced ischemia. That is something as simple as giving a speech impromptu can actually cause decreased blood flow to the heart. Compared to routine stress testing, or what's called mental stress-induced ischemia, how do those things stack up with regard to future cardiovascular events? This was a study that combined 2 studies of just over 900 individuals with documented coronary disease or a previous heart attack. And they put them on a treadmill to see how many of them had treadmill-induced ischemia and how many have had a mental stress. The mental stress was they gave them a topic. They had 2 minutes to prepare. They had to give a 3-minute speech afterwards. And then during this stressful time, they looked to see whether it affected the blood flow to the heart. About a third of the individuals had conventional ischemia on a stress test. About 16% had only ischemia during mental stress, and about 10% had ischemia during both the stress test and mental stress. And they followed these individuals over the course of about 5 to 6 years. Those that had mental induced stress had 2 to 2.5-fold increased risk of having a heart attack or a heart failure compared to people that had no ischemia at all. You say, well, what about those that had a routine stress test? Well, they actually had no significant increase in the risk either compared to those people that had no ischemia. If you had both, it increased your risk 4-fold. The mental stress not only increases your heart rate and blood pressure, but it also probably affects what's called the microcirculation. That is the small blood vessels in the heart that the routine stress test doesn't affect. Individuals that have blockages in the major arteries and the small vessel disease, they're the ones that appear to be more likely to have heart attacks and heart failure in the future.
Of course, 2 things occur to me instantly. One of them is when we're talking about, let me call it microvascular disease, we know that diabetes is a huge risk factor for that and really is an underlying mechanism. So I guess my question is, let's talk about the incidence of diabetes in these folks. Is that something that was identified?
It was, Elizabeth. They looked at all the routine risk factors. About 30 to 40% of these individuals had diabetes. About 3/4 of them had high cholesterol, and about 3/4 had hypertension. And that's why they had coronary artery disease. But the major thing is that individuals with the mental induced stress, they got ischemia at a very low increase in heart rate and blood pressure. It was the mental stress that did it and identified those with small vessel disease. Can we use this as another risk factor identification? Certainly seems that way. Should we be measuring mental stress-induced ischemia in everybody? It certainly raises these questions.
And of course, we're totally familiar with this idea of broken heart syndrome, this mass release of catecholamines and how that can really impact in a very negative way on heart function. I guess that I'm not surprised then this relationship between the brain and the body could result in increased risk for adverse cardiovascular events.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm surprised at, Elizabeth, is we think that the routine stress test is the best way of identifying who's at risk, but we're missing out on probably a bigger risk factor, and that is, how does mental stress identify individuals at increased risk, or is that potentially modifiable?
I guess another question that I would add to this in these subsequent studies would be, is this a propensity that increases with age?
Great question. This is the largest database that's ever looked at it, and the first one to actually compare in males, females, and in minority individuals to identify the importance of mind-heart relationship.
Since we're talking about mind-based things, let's turn to JAMA Internal Medicine, a very intriguing study, taking a look at the association of self-reported COVID-19 infection, SARS-CoV-2 serology test results, and persistent physical symptoms that are attributed to COVID-19 among a bunch of French adults. They have an ongoing study that's called Constance's cohort. And in this big study, in this particular analysis, they looked at over 26,000, almost 27,000 participants who had complete data. Their mean age, 49.4 years. They had a serology test for SARS-CoV-2, and they also surveyed their persistent potential symptoms that were related to COVID-19 infection. They adjusted this thing for all kinds of stuff: age, sex, income, and educational level. For one thing, there's no significant interaction between their belief and their serology test results. What they do find is that persistent physical symptoms after COVID-19 infection may be associated more with the belief that you have been infected than if you had a confirmed COVID-19 infection. It causes them to raise the flag of anybody who's talking about long COVID, they may actually have some entirely different thing going on that they're attributing to that.
Elizabeth, this is really a fascinating study. As you said, it's people that had COVID-like symptoms, but they hadn't been tested. And then they said, oh gosh, I've got long haul symptoms as a result of it. And when they tested them, gosh, half of them never had COVID at all. Are there other things that may be contributing to long haul symptoms? That's one possible explanation. We've talked about stress, anxiety, depression, how that's increased in individuals, not only that have COVID, but even in those that are worried about getting COVID or those that think they may have had COVID. One interesting thing is there was one symptom, anosmia. That is, if you lost your sense of smell, that correlated pretty well with serology.
Exactly sure what we do with this. Do we say, hey, you're a malingerer? Or we say, let's do a blood test. And with everybody vaccinated and lots of people getting infected, even when they're fully vaccinated, that's not really going to help us very much. So what do we do with this?
I do think it's important if people believe they've had COVID infections, they've not been tested, it needs to be verified one way or another. There are a lot of businesses where people are unable to work or feel like they're unable to work because they have long haul symptoms, when in fact they may have never had COVID at all.
No doubt we're going to hear more about this. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, a technique for looking at PCI and then comparing that with coronary bypass surgery.
We're going to focus on those that have multivessel coronary artery disease. In general, for those people with multivessel disease, bypass surgery long-term has been more beneficial than stents. That's old data. We have better stents, more likely to be long-lasting, less likely to have recurrent blockage or to have clot form in this. And the second is we have better ways of identifying who would benefit from a stent. We have something called fractional flow reserve. You can look at a picture of an artery, and sometimes it's a very severe blockage. Sometimes it's a very mild blockage. There are some that are in the middle. And you say, well, gosh, is it reducing blood flow? And we have ways of measuring that in the cardiac cath lab. Okay, we got better techniques for identifying who might benefit from stent. We got better stents. If we compare these to bypass surgery, is it as good? Is it about equivalent? So they tested that in 1,500 individuals. And when they looked at over the course of 1 year, who had the most major cardiovascular events, bypass surgery was in fact better.
Of course, the whole issue of bypass surgery is just so much more invasive than the placement of stents. And clearly, that's one of the major benefits to stent placement. Tell me about populations or subpopulations of patients in whom you would place a stent instead of doing bypass surgery.
I'm glad you mentioned that. To get randomized, you had to be acceptable for having stenting or acceptable for having bypass surgery. There are some individuals in whom the risk of bypass surgery is so incredibly high that you would offer stenting, even though the results may not be quite as favorable.
I'm guessing that as the technology continues to improve, I think maybe we might move more toward a benefit of stenting over time. What would you hypothesize?
Well, Elizabeth, it's kind of interesting because stenting gets better, so does bypass surgery. Everything's getting better. And that's why studies like this are important, where you compare the most up-to-date or recent advances in bypass surgery and stenting.
Finally, let's turn to a study again in NEJM that's looking at this 100,000 genomes pilot on rare disease diagnosis and healthcare. And this is their preliminary report. They cite some pretty startling statistics in their introduction, and I want to cite those as we're talking about this. One of them is that 6% of the population in Western societies can actually be impacted by a rare disease. 1/3 of children with a rare disease will die before their fifth birthday. And in the UK, at least, they define a rare disease as a disorder affecting less than or equal to 1 in 2,000 persons. So this is a pilot study that involves 4,660 participants from just under 2,200 families. There were 161 disorders that actually did cover a broad spectrum of rare diseases. They found that their diagnostic yields, they did all kinds of different things with these folks, gene panels, phenotypes, all of that, and identification of novel pathogenic variants. Their yield was highest in family trios, where they had both parents and a proband who were included in this, and families who already had large pedigrees. They found that their diagnostic yield was much higher if this disorder had a monogenic cause. That was 35% versus a complex cause. That only was 11%. Yields for intellectual disability, hearing disorders, and vision problems ranged from 40 to 55%. They were able to make a genetic diagnosis in 1/4 of the probands. And they started citing some of the stories, which of course are very compelling for me at the end of the paper. So I'll refer listeners to the end of this paper because some of them are really pretty powerful. Their cohort-wide burden testing across 57,000 genomes enabled the discovery of 3 new disease genes and 19 new associations. Of these genetic diagnoses they made, 1/4 of them had immediate ramifications for their clinical decision-making. So I would say, once again, just like with the stents and an improvement in technology, that as this technology goes forward and continues to improve, this is a pretty powerful argument for doing this kind of work.
This came from the National Health Service in England, which is typically a pretty conservative organization. Several things made this possible. One is a recognition that about 80% of rare diseases have a genetic component, and now the ability to do whole genome sequencing very quickly and inexpensively. This project started in 2013. Based upon the results of this particular study, now the National Health Services in England is making genome sequencing a first-line test in individuals that have intellectual disability and other specific disorders. As you mentioned, it's better if you have a bigger family to test. I actually think, again, to know the diseases that we didn't know anything about now, at least 1/4 of them, we can now identify what the cause is. That provides not only therapeutic implications, but also genetic counseling about whether other family members could be affected or could this be spread.
And I think that this is going to be the launching pad for even further analysis of things that are much more common and their genetic basis and susceptibility as well.
So this was a test of over 100,000 whole genomes. They've now expanded it. So their process is sequencing 500,000 whole genomes in not only rare diseases, but also cancer.
No doubt more to come. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.